From the 1600s all the way up through the early 1800s, the British Royal Navy made a practice of forcing men into service aboard their ships. This practice was called impressment. In today's story, The Impressed American, we hear the tale of Walter Grafton, a broken old wretch who returns to New Hampshire after 25 years spent impressed in the British Navy. Welcome back to the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast. I'm your host, Malcolm Torres. It's great to have you back here. I have a story for you today, and I'm so excited about this story, I just want to get right into it. So let's get a quick word from our sponsor, and then off we go. Today's story, the title is Walter Grafton, The Impressed American. And it starts with a little, I don't know if this was a song, maybe it was a little poem back in the day, but it goes like this. Flag of the seas on ocean wave, thy stars shall glitter over the brave. Each dying wanderer of the sea shall look at once to heaven and thee, and smile to see thy splendors fly in triumph over his closing eye. By Drake. So I'll have to look that up and find out who that is, but let's get on with the story. Walter Grafton, the Impressed American. A number of years since, a traveler, apparently old and infirm, early one morning in summer, with slow and tottering steps, ascended the summit of a hill which commanded a view of a beautiful village situated in the valley beneath, on the bank of one of those clear and swift-rushing streams which are so frequently seen in New England, fertilizing the soil and giving a romantic beauty to the landscape. He was a man of a sinewy frame, but care or disease had laid upon it a heavy hand, and the flesh had withered beneath the touch. His cheeks were thin, haggard, and bronzed by exposure for years to the rays of a tropical sun. His locks were thin and gray and hung in straggling masses upon his shoulders, and his hazel eyes, keen and restless, as they surveyed the wide amphitheater beneath him, assumed a wild and mournful expression. That man, after an absence in foreign climes of more than a quarter of a century, had returned to the spot which gave him birth. He was not old in years, but exposure, hardship, sorrow, oppression, and disease had broken his spirits, destroyed his vigorous constitution, and brought on premature old age. When he left his native home, his friends, and his kindred, he was a noble specimen of manhood. He returned no longer a man, but a wreck of humanity. Walter Grafton was a New England sailor, and ere misfortune had palsied his frame and chilled his heart with her spells. He was brave, generous, and noble-hearted, with buoyant spirits and an ingenuousness of disposition which secured him the kind wishes of all who knew him. He was about 22 years of age when he left the pleasant village of Fallingsburg, after a visit of a few weeks, with a light heart, for he had but just entered on the threshold of manhood, and hope, with her magic but deceiving glass, showed him his pathway strewn with gay and fragrant flowers. He left behind him dear friends. Among them was one fair being who had promised to share his lot through life, be it weal or woe. And as the stagecoach in which he was seated slowly ascended the rising ground that overlooked the village, he felt proud of his health, of his vigorous frame, of his native energy, and is implicitly believed that he could successfully carve out his own fortune and to a very considerable extent shape his own destiny. He sailed from Boston as second mate on the brig Volant, bound in voyage to Antigua. He was a faithful officer, he loved his profession, and hoped soon to be promoted to the highest step. But, during a severe hurricane, the Volant was wrecked on the low island of Barbuda, and only Walter and two of his shipmates were saved. The kind inhabitants of the island relieved the immediate wants of the shipwrecked mariners, and in the course of a few days an opportunity offered of proceeding to St. Bartholomew's in a Swedish drawer, from which place he hoped to procure without difficulty a passage to America. but the Drower was hardly cleared the harbor, and when she was fallen in with by the British sloop of war Ringdove, of 18 guns, and the eyes of the boarding officers sparkled with joy when they beheld among the passengers Walter Grafton and his two shipmates, all fine-looking American seamen and without protections. Walter told his story, and the Englishmen knew that he spoke the truth. They were convinced by his statements that those men were American seamen, victims of misfortune. They were aware that their duty as honest men and Christians required them to relieve their wants, so far as it might be in their power, and aid them in returning to their own country. But the British Navy wanted men, and in those days the British officers were too often unscrupulous with regard to the means by which men were procured. Walter Grafton and his companions were declared to be Englishmen and sternly ordered into the boat. They were impressed on board the English man of war. This was a terrible disappointment to the hopes of the young American. The airy palaces which his imagination had erected began to fall to the ground, for he had always regarded as one of life's severest ills the fate of the poor sailor on board a British man of war, and he found the reality far worse than the ideal picture. He resolved, however, to escape from this floating prison if any opportunity should offer, and one dark night, as the Ringdove was at anchor off the harbor of St. George's in Grenada, he quietly let himself down into the water with a view to swim to the shore a distance of about half a mile. But he was seen by a marine on duty who fired at him and lodged a ball in his shoulder. A cutter was instantly manned, a blue light shone, and Grafton was discovered and brought on board bleeding and deeply mortified at the failure of his attempt to escape. In order to set the wholesome example before the crew of the Ringdove and deter others from making a similar attempt, he was tied to the gangway. A few days afterwards, by orders of the captain, and in presence of the whole ship's company, 5 dozen lashes were inflicted upon the bare back of this young American sailor. Grafton was subsequently drafted into a frigate, soon after which war was declared between England and the United States. But his repeated representations that he was an American citizen were unheeded or scoffed at by his officers. On one occasion, a ship with the Stars and Stripes waving at her peak hove in sight, and preparations were made for an obstinate engagement. Walter resolutely persisted in a determination to take no part in the battle. He declared that nothing should induce him to fight against his countrymen, and for adopting this noble and patriotic course, which should have elicited the praise and admiration of brave and honorable men, he was again inhumanly scourged. The frigate was ordered to England, to the great satisfaction of Grafton, who confidently relied on receiving justice and being liberated whenever he should reach a British port, and hope began to revisit his bosom. But this poor, friendless young man found that his statements were as much disregarded or ridiculed at Plymouth as in an obscure port in the West Indies or on the high seas. And while the officers of the ship were absent on furlough or on leave, and could partake of amusements on shore or visit their friends at home, this hapless foreigner was compelled to remain in that worst of prisons, a British man of war, with no prospect of liberation, excepting by the hands of death. In a few weeks, Grafton was drafted into another frigate, which was fitting away for the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, and compelled, against his will, to embark and assist in maintaining aboard the glory of the British name. Thus the bright sky which cheered his soul in the morning of life was obscured with dark and gloomy clouds. He proved to his sorrow that his destiny was shaped by a mighty and unseen power, and that dark and inscrutable by mortals are the works of divine providence. And for years he submitted to his fate and endured all the privations, the cruelties, the hardships, the injustices, which in those days were the lot of the unfortunate men who fought the great battles of Great Britain on the seas and sustained the honor of the British flag. His whole character, as well as his person, became materially changed. Hope and ambition no longer nerved his arm or excited his energies to action. His proud spirit was subdued, and despairing of any favorable change of fortune, he became reckless even of existence. Home, a word around which cluster associations of the most blissful, pure, and holy character, in the minds of the great mass of mankind seemed to Walter Grafton only the faint foreshadowing of a dream, a happy vision of the past, which he felt could never be realized, a mockery. But he lived on. He seemed to bear a charmed life. His shipmates fell beside him in battle, or were swept away by the hands of disease, and their places were supplied by other unfortunate men, without regard to country or the flag under which they sailed. It was sufficient that a British man of war wanted seamen, and whenever they were met with in those seas, no questions were asked, no protestations or entreaties were listened to. They were ruthlessly seized, whether Dane, Swede, Dutchman, or Yankee, and compelled to submit to perpetual and barbarous slavery in the service of the King of Great Britain. But Grafton still loved his country and revered her free institutions, and he would have given worlds to have stood on the deck of an American ship, battling with all his energies against the naval forces of Great Britain. From the bottom of his heart, he detested that power which had torn him from his friends and dashed to the earth the cup of joy, even while hope was holding it at his lips. Grafton was finally transferred to a small brig of war, sent on a dangerous exploring expedition to the Carolina Islands. In the course of a few months, the brig was wrecked upon a coral reef, and the greater portion of the crew perished before they could reach the shore. Walter and a few of his shipmates survived the disaster, but were treated with great cruelty by the natives, and all, himself excepted, in a short time sank under the tortures which were inflicted by the savages. With a view of testing their courage and fortitude, Grafton passed the ordeal, was created a chief, and treated with favor. He passed several years on the island, enduring a miserable existence, and without partaking in any of the enjoyments of life, when, to his delight, a small vessel appeared in the offing, with an American flag flying at her masthead. It was a schooner from a New England port, seeking for Becklemer and pearl oysters. A thrill of delight passed through his frame as he beheld the vessel, and he secretly resolved to escape from the island or perish in the attempt. When night spread her veil over the surrounding objects, Walter Grafton stealthily left his wigwam and hastened to the beach. In a few minutes, he had launched a canoe, and with all the strength and skill which he possessed, he was paddling from the shore in the direction of the schooner. But he was watched, the alarm was given, and he was pursued by the indignant savages. He heard their yells of vengeance as they rapidly drew near, and, with all the energy of despair, he redoubled his exertions. At length he saw the schooner through the gloom. He hailed her, and in good English implored succor. The captain understood the case immediately, and promptly determined to aid the fugitive. He fired a shot at the fleet of canoes, which induced them to abandon the chase. But not before one of the savages, a chief of giant size and vigorous arm, had launched a spear at the unfortunate Grafton, which pierced his thigh and crippled him for life. The next moment, Walter was on board the American vessel and welcomed with kindness and cordiality by the noble-hearted commander. His wish was now to return to his native country. He longed to behold again the hills and vales of New England, and to repose after death in the land of his fathers. But although he rejoiced to find himself on board an American vessel, he was still far distant from his home, and was reluctantly compelled to visit many places, traverse many seas, and suffer various hardships before he again planted his foot on the American soil. He also saw more than once, proudly steaming to the breeze, the Red Cross flag of Great Britain, and while he gazed upon it, his eye would kindle with frenzy, his whole frame tremble with passion, and amid the incoherent ravings of a madman, he would mutter curses upon the nation, which, to extend their national glory, would violate all the principles of honor and justice, and enslave and torture the free and brave of other countries who owed no allegiance to the would-be mistress of the sea. When this sad victim of British oppression landed on the wharf in Boston, he was rapidly sinking into the grave. He was but 50 years of age, yet life's candle was already burnt to the socket, and his stooping figure, his wrinkled features and hoary locks, seemed to say that he had passed more years than are usually allotted to man. He was a stranger in his native land, a cripple, without money, without friends, without health. He did not tarry in the flourishing city, for he felt that he had no time to lose, but immediately commenced his journey on foot to the spot which 25 years before he had left in joyous spirits, exulting in the possession of a vigorous constitution and manly qualities that he was confident would soon place him at the head of his profession and secure him the respect and esteem of the wise and the good. In such guise and under such circumstances did Walter Grafton return to his native village. He stood upon the summit of the hill and gazed upon the scenes around him. He beheld the same beautiful stream and the same secluded valley in which the hamlet where he was born was located, but most of the prominent features of the landscape, indelibly stamped upon his memory, were no longer there. The old church, with its lofty spire, like an inverted tunnel, which he had often gazed upon with reverence and awe, and beneath whose spacious roof he had often listened to the precepts of the man of God, had been taken away, and in its place was supplied by several edifices of inferior dimensions and modern style. The schoolhouse of wood, where he passed many of the happiest days of his life and eagerly drank in the seeds of knowledge, was removed from its romantic site by the banks of the limpid stream, and several unsightly and shapeless cotton factories covered and surrounded the spot. The stately elm trees, which constituted one of the proudest ornaments of the village, and which were formerly religiously treasured and cherished by the worthy inhabitants, had fallen beneath the axe of the spoiler, a victim to the march of improvements. Even the unpretending hamlet, with its old-fashioned mansions, its common, its green lanes lined with umbrageous forest trees, had disappeared, and in its stead had arisen, as if by magic, a flourishing manufacturing town, with its straight streets, its numerous stores and taverns, and its comfortless brick dwellings. And the village burial ground, the last resting place of the inhabitants, where in early youth he had seen the remnants of a beloved and indulgent mother deposited, and where he had passed many mournful but delicious hours reclining on the green and flowery turf which covered her grave, had not been spared. The sacred spot was covered with a range of three-story granite stores. The heart of the wanderer sank within him at the sight. He looked for his home, but he saw it not. He could not even find the graves of his fathers. He turned away in the bitterness of his disappointment and sobbed like a child. His attention was soon attracted to the shouts of some young men and boys who ascended the hill, bearing a long pole, and who, by their smiling countenances, were evidently about to undertake some interesting task. They beheld the old man, with tears upon his cheeks, leaning against a rough mass of granite, and their sympathy as well as their curiosity was excited. One of the number, a fine-looking youth, about 20 years old, respectfully approached him, and while his companion proceeded in their work, in kind accents he inquired of the forlorn stranger the cause of his grief. The old man made no direct reply to the question, but in eager and tremulous accents said, "Tell me, oh tell me, young man, if any person reside in yonder town by the name of Grafton." "No," replied the youth, "the last person of that name who resided in Fallingsburg was Walter Grafton, who, with his wife and children, left this part of the country to settle in Illinois about 5 years ago. But why do you ask?" A deep groan was the only reply to his question. The old man pressed his hand firmly to his brow, as if he wished to suppress the strong emotion which shook his soul. In a few moments, he again asked in a hesitating but subdued tone of voice, as if he feared the tenor of the reply, "Can you tell me if you ever heard the name of such a person in this village as Helen Stockton?" "Helen Stockton!" exclaimed the youth with unequivocal marks of surprise. "Helen Stockton, to be sure, I have heard of her. Helen Stockton was the name of my mother." The burning hectic, which had flushed the wan and haggard and scarred cheeks of the stranger, now gave place to a ghastly pallor. At this moment, his attention was attracted by some loud huzzas from the party who, for some moments, had been busily at work but a few rods off. He looked up and saw that they had planted a flagstaff from which depended, in graceful folds, the American ensign. "What is the meaning of this?" said he to the young man, who still lingered near him, actuated partly by curiosity and partly by a better feeling. "This," said the young man in a triumphant voice, while his eyes sparkled with the fires of patriotism, "this is the 4th of July, the birthday of American independence. Hurrah!" The old sailor with difficulty raised himself from his reclining posture and limped toward the flagstaff. He fixed an intense gaze on the stars and stripes which floated above him, the emblem of freedom and of union, the rallying point of the friends to the rights of man in every part of the globe. He took the old tarpaulin hat from his head and summoned back for a moment his departing energies. Three times he waved that hat high above his head, and three times, with a voice as clear, as loud, and as startling as the tone of a trumpet, he shouted, "Hurrah! Hurrah! Hurrah!" The dying sailor sank exhausted on the ground at the foot of the flagstaff. The young men on the hill, astonished at his enthusiasm, hastened to his assistance, but it was not needed. The spirit was departed, and thus on the green hill, overlooking his native valley, a stranger, destitute, crippled, and forlorn, perished, the hapless victim of British impressment. The tale of Walter Grafton is not a mere sketch of the imagination. It is only one of many cases of wrong and oppression which grew out of the practice of impressment and are calculated to excite the sympathies and rouse the indignation of every honest heart. But let us rejoice that such times have passed away. The impressment of seamen is no longer authorized in the English Navy. It was a vile and barbarous custom even when the victims were British subjects, but when men belonging to other nations are ruthlessly kidnapped and forcibly dragged from their homes upon the deep and compelled to serve on board a British man of war, the outrage is of a nature so horrible, so contrary to all the recognized principles of honor and justice, that the whole civilized world should rise up en masse and exclaim against it. We do not believe that the British government will ever again dare to resort to this mode of manning their ships during a time of war. The subject was agitated during the Ashburton Treaty with Great Britain, and the letter of Daniel Webster upon the subject of impressment is one of the ablest documents which ever came from his hand. It does honor to his head and to his heart, and the American sailor owes a debt of gratitude to that enlightened statesman who, in bold and decided language, proclaim to the world that the American flag shall protect the American seamen. That was pretty heavy. Most of these stories in ocean adventures are like sea stories, you know. This is the first one that has a kind of a strong political message. It was pretty cool, though. And it makes me think really about the political and the social climate in the 1860s when this book was published. It talks about freedom and the rights of man. Good stuff. Well, shipmates, there's another sea story in the books for us. As I've mentioned many times on the podcast, folks, I have written quite a few novels and sea stories myself. One easy way, no cost, that you can check out my writing is there's a short story. This story is called 64 Days. And here's just a brief description of the story. Brendan O'Reilly is working on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier, the most dangerous 4.5 acres on the planet. Today, O'Reilly has to stop daydreaming about retiring and visiting national parks with his lovely wife, Diane. Today, he and his shipmates will face a horrible disaster during which they must save their ship and keep themselves alive. This is one of the sea stories in the Sea Adventure Collection by Malcolm Torres. These stories are often free on Amazon and iBooks and Smashwords, and Barnes & Noble, and they can be read in any order. So this is a short story. It's called 64 Days, and it's by me, Malcolm Torres, and it's free across all the e-reader platforms.
I would just ask that you go grab a copy of this, read it, and post an honest review. And if you enjoy it, there are several more novels and several more short stories with similar types of plots and characters available there. So thank you so much, shipmates.
I really appreciate you following along here. And if you really are into sea stories and science fiction, you've got to check out my YouTube channel. I'm reviewing books on there. I've got lots of reviews on great and obscure sea stories and science fiction. Just look me up. The link is in the show notes. And follow me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Thanks, and until the next time, we'll see you later.